Welcome to the Atwell Podcast.
Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm excellent. I can't help but kind of creep on your profile page. I noticed that you were in Paris.
Yeah, I just got back. It was an international women's conference.
And how do you even get to, like, do you just have people that reach out to, like, conferences and then their people get a hold of your people? Or how do you get into doing that?
Well, this, Randy, was a really interesting model. Okay. And you can go on their website, and when we're done, I'll send you the link. But they reached out to me. Okay. I asked them when I got there. It's a company out of India.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And what they do is they sponsor about, I don't know, 8 to 10 conferences a year at different locations in the world. And basically you pay the registration fee. Then they give you a 25-minute slot to speak.
Oh, wow.
You can either do it virtually or in person. Okay. Well, they're an Indian company and they're hard to deal with. Okay. So getting responses, all that kind of stuff. So finally, I decided, okay, I went over there honestly because my grandson lives in Spain. And he can fly from my son and grandson. They can fly from Marbella, Spain to Paris in 2.5 hours, one flight. So I said to them, if I'm in Paris, will you come fly over and see me? Okay. So we met in Paris, right? But that was the big reason I went. Okay. But I wanted to see how the conference works also. And so then you just pay the registration fee. They put you on their docket and you get 25 minutes to speak.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I was, I had the most imposter syndrome I think I've ever felt, because while you were in Paris, I was hanging out with Danny Trejo, the actor, and I was talking to his agent, trying to get him on the podcast. And I looked down at myself and I'm thinking, as poor as I've been at my background, where I come from, and I'm still in West Virginia in a trailer park even today. And I'm like, this is just a wild world. Like, I have a meeting with Ruby Payne, who's in Paris. And I'm standing here talking to Danny Trejo, and I'm like way down on the totem pole. So that leads me to my first question. You've obviously seen a lot of people change classes, financial classes.
Right.
Does the imposter syndrome stay with you forever?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at the situation. Okay. Basically, everybody's an imposter. In one area of your life or another, you're an imposter, okay, because you don't really feel comfortable in that space, okay? So the bottom line is, I don't see it that way. I see it this way, okay, that I'm a child of God, and there's work I'm supposed to do, okay? So I'm going to do that work, all right, and let the pieces fall where they may. So that doesn't make me an imposter or anything else. It just is, this is the reality. I had these experiences so I can function over here. Doesn't mean I'm going to not make mistakes, but it means that this is part of the path. So I think probably, I love this metaphor out of India. They tell this story that, I don't know if you know, but in India, you carry water, okay? And what you do is you carry, it's better if you can carry it on a piece of wood that balances both sides. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking
about. Like when I was over there, I gave money to help fund this middle school in Missouri, okay, up in the mountains. And these kids, they kind of had a celebration for me for the financial contribution I'd given to them. These kids had walked 4 hours to get to school, okay? And each way, okay, every day, right? And before they walked 4 hours, they had to carry water. The girls had to carry water into their household for the day before they could come to school, okay? And there's this story told in India that carrying a water pot, and one of the pots had a crack in it, okay? And the pot apologize for having a crack in it. And the response was, no, I needed that crack in you because you watered the flowers along the path every morning when you walked for me. Okay. And so the thing of it is that you, nor I, nor any human being quite understands their role and what they're supposed to do and the value or benefit down the road. So that's why I don't really think about the imposter syndrome at all.
For me, I don't know if I've shared this with you or not, but for me, I have a very specific life goal, and that is to help impoverished people in other countries. Quite literally, I just want to, I want to be able to go to a place and know that there's an income coming in, but for me to be of service to these impoverished countries. So when you tell me stories like that, and then when you went to Haiti, it really hits home because I have put in so much work in school and just trying to get my financial stuff together. And it is extremely difficult. It is extremely difficult. And you have to have resources, you have to have education. And I thank the Lord that I had the mindset to admit that I was wrong on a lot of things because I turned 30 with an eighth grade education and a GED from West Virginia and not a job around paying more than $30,000 a year. Well, obviously, that's not going to get me to helping people internationally. So I had to change my course. So,
But one of the things that I'm going to recommend to you and to your audience is this website called www.mindmovies.com. And what you do is you make a mind movie of your future 10 years down the road, okay? And you play that video. It allows you to custom make it to the way you want for your life. And you put pictures in there and music with it, and you watch it every day, okay? And one of the things that allows you to get past difficulties is to have this future story of where you want to be. And what you understand then along that way is that the difficulties or whatever it is are all pieces of learning you need to have in order to get to that next place. So I would recommend that for you, for your, you got a goal, you got a future story. Now flesh it out a little bit. What's that look like? And just because it doesn't happen, everything you thought, you're still, because I've had people say to me, Ruby, you know, what if I don't get there? I said, well, at least you're halfway further than you were without it.
I have friends who are locally who say, Randy, you really need to focus on your local community. And I do, just like everybody else, I pay tithes, I donate to local food banks and stuff like that. I guess what really got me, Ruby, and you probably know what I'm talking about here, is when you're looking at poverty internationally, it's different because there's not as many opportunities to get out, in my opinion. I was in Bethlehem, for instance, a few years ago, and I could see feces on the street. And you got the big, huge West Bank wall, and you got a Palestinian government that was exploiting people. That's what everyone told me. Basically, the American government had given them hundreds of millions of dollars. The Palestinian government takes it, leaves for Iran, doesn't help the infrastructure. So, it was just a breeding ground for terrorism and poverty. And when I was looking at that, I was like, a lot of it's out of my hands. I get that. But when I look at that compared to a person who has an opportunity to work who maybe doesn't work, it's really difficult for me to say that the people in maybe Bethlehem doesn't deserve my help more than the people here locally. Does that make sense?
Right, but that's not, I think, the issue. The issue is where are you called to work?
That's a good point.
See, there, you can go to San Francisco and there's feces on the street.
Yeah, you make a good point.
Yeah.
Philadelphia is the same way. New Orleans is the same way.
Yep. So it really, honestly, so where are you called to serve and where are you called to work? And I think everybody's got an opinion. I'll tell you something my dad told me. He told me, he said, Ruby, if nobody has anything good to say about you, that's not good. If nobody has anything bad to say about you, That's not good because it means you're not doing anything. So if you're actually doing things, you're going to have people on both sides of the coin talking about you. What I've learned is you have to figure out that's just another voice in the picture, but I don't have to. I've got critics all over the place. I got a guy who said publicly it's his goal to destroy me and the work. I mean, there's a they're there.
Wow.
Huh?
What was his reasoning? I mean, does he just have different opinions on the same issue or?
Well, he used a lot of criticism of me to pick to grow his own career.
So he's using yours to piggyback. But
And you have
obviously.
that same thing will happen to you. So just know it's going to happen.
Yeah. The biggest thing that I keep hearing from me is because I'm working on so many projects. See, I manage a company that has 30 locations. So I'm in charge of it all. And so I have a lot of responsibility. Of course, my wife dealt with health and I'm still a dad and I'm in college. So I'm putting in so many hours with one goal to help people. And a lot of people around me will say that it's a midlife crisis. But maybe to some extent that is correct, but also Carl Jung, I mean, he's like, life doesn't begin till you're 40, so I don't feel old. I'm 33, but I don't feel old at all. I feel like I could start over again and do a whole thing and be 40 and be fine. I don't get why. And again, with the podcasting thing, you were actually a big influence on that because of your stance on relationships and getting out of poverty. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't agree with it at first. I thought that it was I thought that with the internet that relationships wasn't as important as what they should have been. However, whenever I take 40 business classes, a specialization in marketing, a specialization in negotiation from Essex Business School, and every single person says that relationships is the most important thing, including the world-renowned expert on poverty, Ruby Payne, in my opinion. It's like, well, Randy, there's a pretty good chance here that you were wrong.
The deal. You in poverty, relationships help you get by, but in wealth, they help you get ahead. So there's two kinds of social capital. One is bonding social capital, which is people like you. The other one is bridging social capital, which are people then different than you. If you want to transition out, you have to have bridging social capital.
The thing that really surprised me the most is how different classes view jobs.
Yes.
I came from restaurant management, so I re managed restaurants for 8 years, albeit small restaurants, Papa John's and Little Caesars. So nobody in the restaurant is making over 40 grand a year. So everybody's poor, and the manager's making 25 cents more than the employees. But now there's a leadership structure,
Us
boss
versus
structure.
them. Yep.
And you're still just as poor as the next guy. He made $500 more a year. So it's an interesting dynamic. But whenever I got into higher level management and started dealing with people in middle to higher class incomes, what I would consider higher class incomes, but they would look at me and they're like, Randy, how in the world did you manage restaurant workers? They all have face tattoos and they're all on drugs. How did you manage that? And I'm like, because I was one of them. What do you mean? Like, that was me too, but they look at it like I'm almost like a prodigy or something.
You are, because what you have is you have a skill set they don't have. See those three circles in the book, middle class, poverty, and wealth? When you start owning your own business, that's what I talked about in Paris. You have to be able to negotiate all three circles, okay? And this was a the women in the audience, they were stunned by it because many of them do have their own company and they had never seen that information before. So one of the things is I think I've dealt a lot in the school business and I'm changing my market focus now. So I think that's another thing. You have to constantly change and adapt, and move your focus.
Where are you moving your market focus now?
I'm working on a book right now called How the Hidden Rules of Social Class Impact Your Career, Your Marriage, and Your Relationships. Like, for example, one of the things that happens when you start developing, let's just talk about friendships and relationships, all right?
Sure.
And I don't really talk about this in the book much, okay? But one of the things that happens in poverty, friendships tend to be transactional. Do you know what I mean? I help you with this, you help me with this, okay? Da, da,
Sure.
da, da, da. In middle class, relationships tend to be, I'm not talking about romantic relationships, I'm talking about friendships, that kind of thing, colleagues. They tend to be more a lot about we're in the same groups, we're in the same activities. I like you like me, we play golf together, you know what I mean? We have tennis together, da, 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 da. But in wealth, they're about the value of your connections. Like in the last 2 years, I've had lunch with three different women. And afterwards, I realized I would never have lunch with them again because they assessed me for the value of my connections. And they decided I didn't have enough connections in the world they need to participate in. One was a military wife, one was a person heavily involved in philanthropic organizations. Okay. So the bottom line is I didn't have the connections for them to spend time with. See, let me explain. You have 24 hours a day, everybody does. So how you spend that time determines to a large extent who you know and what you know. So the bottom line, it wasn't anything about me personally. It was just, no, you don't have enough connections for me to give you time in the world I want to participate in. Like, for example, I know a guy who's a multimillionaire. He started his own business, and his daughter was dating a billionaire. Okay. And the billionaire his daughter was dating said to the father, he said, who was a multimillionaire, he said, "You know what? Your family doesn't really have anything to offer me. You don't have anybody who's a lawyer. You don't have a doctor in there. You don't have an accountant in there. You don't have an investment manager in your family. You don't really have anything to offer me. So why would I want to spend time with you? Do you follow me?"
Yeah, I do.
And I'm thinking, well, thank God he didn't, they didn't get married. Do you know what I mean? With an
Yeah,
attitude
right.
like that, you know? But the bottom line is that's not an unusual mindset. Okay. What's the value of the connection? All right. And there's a big difference in how new money and old money thinks about it. New money's got the old come, the income. New money's got the income. Old money's got the connections. All right. So new money will marry old money. Okay. Because of the way private clubs work and connections work. And so it's an interesting dilemma. I had a guy in Minneapolis who runs museums, and he said, "Ruby, we've learned that if we want to have a fundraiser, we better double check the calendars of people from old money, okay, first. But if we want the fundraiser to work, we have to have new money in it because they got the cash."
The thing that's sort of on my mind with the fundraising is like, is it just about the connections that you have to raise funds, or is it or does the companies already have contacts on the book? So in other words, like, how is people being hired for those positions?
Which positions?
Well, the people who would have to go out and fundraise. Like, is that from, in other words, if I wanted to be in I can't say it.
Philanthropic?
Yeah, sorry. If I wanted to be in that type of work, would the company, like, if I work for Red Cross, would they provide the connections that I needed, or would I have to bring them to the
They
table?
would want you to bring them to the table. Look, let me explain. One of the
Mm-hmm.
people say this to me. I don't understand why they paid $10,000 for a table at that charity event or $20,000 for the table at the charity event. And they'd only seated 8 people. Well, they're not buying the food. Okay. When you buy a table at 20, 30 grand, that means that you have the right to be introduced to other people there. So what you're,
Mm-hmm.
See, in wealth, you are introduced. If you meet somebody, if you go to a party among the wealthy, you're introduced. That's indication. This is a person that's safe to know and they have connections. Okay. So the bottom line is it gives you the right to be introduced because you had the resources to buy a table there.
That makes a lot of sense. How I got introduced to different agents, I got introduced to four different agents. And mind you, I don't have 20 to 30 grand myself. So what I decided to do was go to a local, well, not local, in Lexington, Kentucky, about 5 hours from me, a comic convention, because I knew that all the celebrities' agents would be there. And I was like, okay, if I get to talk to them, throw enough darts at the board, so to speak, then maybe I can get into a discussion. So my plan ended up working. It was a lot cheaper than $20,000 to $30,000 a table. I wonder if there's specific people that they already know is going to be there, and then they and then that's what makes them buy the tables, I guess.
Well, or they want to have access or support somebody who's sponsoring that particular charity event. Okay. Like for example, if you're a hospital charity, okay, all right, you may support that charity because of your child's situation, okay, or a loved one's situation, all right. So it depends what the charity is and the reason you're supporting it. But one of the things is people who want to climb the social ladder, one of the things they find out who supports which charities. And then the way they get in the door is they volunteer to work the charity for no money because that gives them access to decision makers.
So obviously, like, you've been probably a part of some of these tables in your career. Was you trying to look at it from an outside, looking in type of view, or was, or did you feel like you were involved, or were you there just trying to gather information, or what
Well,
was
sometimes
your
I was there to speak. Okay.
okay.
Sometimes you're there to participate. The thing that I, well, first of all, and I believe you give back. Okay. So tithing and that kind of thing. Okay. But one of the things is that how can I say this? All right. I find closed systems claustrophobic, so mentally claustrophobic. Let me explain what I mean by a closed system. I'm in this group, and there's criteria for getting in and out of this group, okay? And if you're in, then there's all these rules you have to follow to stay in the group. Do you follow me? So, like, I was raised Mennonite, which is a religion, kind of like Amish, okay? And it's basically a closed system. The only way you can be Mennonite is either to be born into it or to convert into it. And then it's a closed system. They kind of decide who you can talk to and who you can't, what rules you have to follow, how you have to live your life. And one of the things about closed systems is then you don't get a lot of new information into your system. So what you spend a lot of time is talking about the people in your system and trying to control them. Do you follow me?
Yeah, I do.
So they eventually become dysfunctional. You see that in high poverty neighborhoods. You see that in wealth. You see it across the board, right? And so right now I know of a exclusive women's group, wealthy women. Okay. They have very strict rules about being in their group. And basically you're either in or out. And then if you're in, you have to follow their rules. Do you follow me? I don't like that. So when you asked me if I'm in a group, am I observing? I like to have the freedom to move in and out different groups of people without belonging to a particular group. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
It does. It does. Actually, I think me and you share that in common. I really enjoy talking to people that, even people that I disagree with, and I don't like feeling like I have to be a part of a clique. My wife was joking just the other day about local sports teams. A lot of times, what we end up seeing with little league football, little league basketball, is that the parents are trying to live out. They get into little cliques and they try to live out their seventh grade clique life.
Fantasy. Yeah.
Yeah, like trying to still be in seventh grade. And my wife and I were sitting there over there on the sidelines looking. It's like, nah, that's not for us, you know. Because, like you said, you got things that you have to abide by. It takes up a lot of your time, and it's really going nowhere.
See, that's part of the problem. When you do what you do or what I did, when you move across classes and you move out and you kind of chart your own path. One of the things it means is you won't ever quite, quote unquote, belong to any group. Okay. And so a lot of people won't do that because they need to belong to a group. Your autonomic nervous system, for you to function, needs to have safety and belonging. Okay. So for some people, they can't deal with that, those stressors of not belonging to a group and having the comfort of a group. So Napoleon Hill, I don't know if you know of his work, Think and Grow Rich.
I'm not familiar with
Oh,
it.
you would love that book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And he wrote that book in the 1920s, okay? And when the stock market crash came in 1929, he spent a couple years researching. He researched and talked to 25,000 people. And he found that only 2% of the population could actually get beyond their fears and chart their own path. And that's been pretty much my experience.
Yeah, and honestly, when you said that, I kind of felt like a little bit of my imposter syndrome came off of me a little bit, because I was like, wait a minute, if I don't necessarily 100% belong, because I'm kind of like on this informational gathering journey in my life, then maybe that's the reason for some of that imposter syndrome.
Right. You're not going to belong. You're not going to belong if you want to chart your own path. Okay. And there are going to be millions of people want to take you apart for that. Okay. Because it for a lot of people who let their fears govern them, okay, not belonging means that I have to make as many people as I can around me belong and do what I think they ought to do.
And it's just a control mechanism. You're just trying
Right.
to control people. And a lot of times when we control people, all it does is makes them want to do the actions even more. I learned that in a book, The Laws of Human Nature by Robert Greene. He also wrote the book, The 48 Laws of Power.
And see, like if we talk about Elon Musk, whether everybody's got an opinion about Elon Musk, okay? But the bottom line, his lifetime goal is to get to Mars. So that everything he has done is to get to that goal. Like the electronic vehicle, he understands if he's going to get to Mars, he has to have batteries, okay? So what he did is he made that open source software so that he could get the best ideas about battery. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Now, then what did he do next? Starlink. Well, why is he doing Starlink? He needs to have a communication system if he's going to go to Mars. And what does that look like? Do you follow me?
Yeah, I do.
Now he's in the US government. People go, why is he doing that? Well, he understands if he's going to have to get to Mars, he's got to have government contracts. Okay. SpaceLink, same diff. So the bottom line is people go, he's crazy. Not if you think about his long-term goal. And does he care if he makes people upset? No, because he's got a goal. And one of the things you understand when you got a goal is you're going to upset a lot of people.
And the thing that I had to start doing, the very first step I made to, because you got to understand that from an eighth grade education with a GED in West Virginia and a dead end job, the very first thing that I had to do for me, I was going to ask if you agreed with it actually, is to sever the relationships that were detrimental to me growing. That was my very first goal because to me, the peer pressure, when people's telling you, college is for, the big thing around here, not to make this overly political, the college is for liberals, and the whole stigma is blue haired, liberal, no knowledge whatsoever, $5 million in debt when you come out, just crazy. And it's a political thing. And for me, I was like, I don't necessarily think so. And then my sister graduated from Ivy League. And she looked at me and was basically like, I don't think you could do it. But she said it nicely. And she was, I felt like she was kind of right. But what she didn't realize was, is that I had spent 4 years reading every business book that I could come up with from, and in my free time, I was sitting there listening to Milton Friedman in the 70s rattle off Federal Reserve numbers and interest rates and that sort of thing. So I was like, let me try and see if I can do this. Well, turns out I'm not as dumb as you look because as dumb as I look because I'm hopefully graduating from a Division I school with a 3.9 GPA in just under a year and a half. So, but the relationships, the
Yeah, you
peer
have to cut
pressure.
them. See, that's one of the rules. Here's one of the rules. When you move from poverty to middle class or middle class to wealth, there's a period of time you have to give up relationships for achievement because you don't have time for them both.
There's a couple relationships that I have that I realize what you're saying is true. But the thing in my mind is I want to bring them with me. And I saw a quote the other day that sort of got to me, and it said that the problem was is I was trying to take people to the top that didn't want to see me there. And it's frustrating because you've got to do it yourself. You can't force other people to think differently. You can't force other people to value education or to value time commitments or meeting arrangements when you have that. I've had so many people that have just totally missed meetings and or was super late to something. And I'm like, guys, you got to be more structured than that to succeed. You can't be an hour and a half late to a meeting. It don't work like that. The person that's waiting on you is going to leave, and you're going to lose and you're going to damage that relationship. You're going to damage that contract. You might lose a contract in the business world over it. So, it's really upsetting to lose the relationships, but I know that it's inevitable.
Right. And you can't take people with you. Okay, so that's the other side. See, I got kicked out of the Mennonite church, okay? Because one, I married my first husband was from West Virginia and he was in the military and they're pacifist, okay? But the thing that you have to understand then, so I kind of have a relationship with my family in which I am see, because then you become one of them, quote unquote. Okay. So once you choose to break a pattern and go beyond it or move outside of it, then it changes the nature of relationships. Okay. It doesn't mean you can't have them. They're just different. Okay. And so you have to have a certain amount of internal strength in order to deal with that.
Oh, it's incredibly difficult. I lived under poverty with two children. I'm in a middle class income now. I make pretty good money. I'm an open book. I get about $1,200 a week. In my area, that's extremely good. It's probably, I don't know how good it would be in Dallas, Texas, but where I'm at, it's very, very good. And I have the money to do some extra stuff with. So I'm very grateful and thank
Here's the
God.
thing to remember is that no matter where you are, you're always going to meet somebody who's got more than you do.
Oh,
Always.
yeah.
And you're always going to meet somebody that's got less than you have. All right?
That's
Always.
something that never bothered me. That's something that I did not have in common with a lot of people in my income bracket, think $20,000 to $30,000 a year prior, less rewind 5 to 6 years ago, I had a friend at the time who was making around $3,000 to $4,000 a week. Now that's a lot of money where I come from. But he was in way more debt than me. He didn't have the expendable income as I did. He mismanaged his money dramatically. And when I had that income, I never felt any jealousy over it. I never felt like you owe me something. I felt like I was underpaid compared to the work that he was doing, but that wasn't his fault. It was. Then once I started learning more about business, I realized that there was an income limit for certain services. So if you work in a restaurant business that's doing $400,000 a year, well, there's a lot of overhead there. Nobody's going to make over 40 grand a year. It's not going to work. The manager might make 30, but everybody else is going to be in the 10 to 15,000 range. And once you realize that, then you realize this line of work isn't sustainable for growth, I guess you can say.
Right. And yeah, I think that's part of the reality there. You have to look at the potential in the environment you're in and what the potential there is, and where you're going to go with it. So what else is on your mind?
Well, honestly, I wanted to tell you thank you for the books. I
Oh, good.
received them. And the fact that you signed them, I literally held them in my arms. See, I do have a couple questions. I want to talk about the books. I don't know if we'll get to today. How long have we been on here?
I
Well,
can be on till 10 o'clock, and then I gotta go. I don't know what your schedule's like today.
yeah. What time is it where you're at now?
I'm sorry, it's 9:30.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. Yeah, we might get to maybe the homelessness and instability, and then we'll get into maybe the emotional poverty in the next one if you're willing.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah,
See,
I
I
want to.
think, let me just say an aside. For me, the biggest issue of getting out of poverty is the emotional issues you have to deal with. Okay. Once you come to terms with what you've come to terms with, I got to work twice as hard as anybody else to get out of this hole. Okay. Once you can, and you look at people, there's a lot of people in wealth who work long, long, long hours. I mean, I don't want to say, but the understanding is that there's a certain amount of grunt work you have to do if you want to get to this goal or dream you got going, okay? Like, if you look at the number of hours that Elon Musk spends sleeping on the floor in his office, do you follow me? You begin to understand there's a price you got to pay, right? And
It's a hard
so,
price. I can tell you that it is a hard price.
I agree. I agree. I agree. I agree. I worked full time and took 9 hours of graduate school when I was working on PhD at a time. Okay. So life is t money is t I mean time is tight. Yeah.
It
Anyway.
just felt so crazy though to be in poverty where the goals that you have are so much different. Like in middle class, as you've pointed out, you're looking at more education to get better jobs. You said that before. It was in your book as well. But in poverty, the goal is basically to make it payday to payday, maybe pick up an extra shift so you can buy a pair of Jordan shoes that are going to be totally ruined within 6 months from use, and or buying assets that are depreciating, no appreciating assets, nothing that lasts. And I just it I felt like when I was in it, I felt like I was going crazy. I felt like this is a path that is like a circle. It goes nowhere forever and ever and ever until you decide to get off that path.
Well, see, you can feel that same way in middle class and in wealth. Okay. What separates it out is if you've got a future story. Okay. Right now, it feels like I'm going in circles. Okay. It feels like I'm in traffic that stopped. Okay. And I'm just sitting there. Okay. But if you know your destination, then it changes the it change it allows you to deal with the uncertainty, the imposter syndrome, if you will, the whatever. Till you can get where you want to go. But there's a lot of middle class people who go in circles. There's a lot of wealth people who go in circles.
One thing I wanted to ask you, a lot of your books are from the perspective of teaching teachers to help students that are experiencing these things. And you come from an educational background, so it makes sense. However, I want to ask if you have, or why you haven't, if you haven't, wrote a book about the perspective of a person coming from poverty out.
One of the things is that one of the things that I talk about a lot in my presentation, but I didn't write a book from that perspective, okay? Because one, I thought there were some good books out there about it already, okay? Not that you can't have another one, like yours would be great, okay? But J.D. Vance has got one. There's some Native American Indian ones, The Glass Menagerie, written by the woman in West Virginia. I mean, there's books about that. I was more interested in saying to educators, here's the reality. The book was so misunderstood for this reason. I only wrote it for one reason. I wrote it so that educators would not be so angry at kids from poverty, okay? When I wrote that book 30 years ago, it was not unusual to hear this comment. That kid's poor and he can't learn, okay? And it was like, no, that's not true, okay? And or they would get punished a kid because they didn't have a pencil, or they'd get angry at them because they would cuss out a teacher, or they would not understand why you can't confront a middle school kid in front of other kids and get away with it. Do you follow me? There's ways to handle it, and you have to confront behavior, but you can't humiliate them in the process and expect you're going to get away with it. Okay. And so they didn't understand that your relationship is your leverage. So I wrote it for educators simply because I wanted kids to have the opportunity to get educated. That was the whole purpose of it. And I had a critic say to me, "Ruby, you're just trying to change the world." I said, "I am not. I'm trying to make sure kids have a choice."
Well, it was definitely, and I know you've heard this a lot of times, it was definitely something that it kind of it went through maybe 10 people to get to me as your first book, because
Talk to me about that. How it got to you?
so obviously I'm talking about a framework for understanding poverty, and basically it was distributed through a line to a teacher in Rupert, West Virginia. Now, Rupert is extremely poor. The biggest store there is a CVS. That's it. There is no grocery store. There's a little pizza restaurant that still has quarter machines called Possum Holler Pizza. It's one of the poorest places that I know of. And my sister was in the foster care system. And this teacher was so flabbergasted about my sister's story from poverty. Mind you, she was about 7 or 8, maybe at the time, maybe even younger, very young. And the teacher's like, "Wow, you've got a lot of problems, kid." And he hands her this book, your book, at like 7, 8 years old. And instead of teaching her, he gives it to her.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So your book was taken from the perspective from my sister, which it was definitely helped her. She ended up graduating Ivy League. Me and her disagree on a number of subjects, but she is educated. She graduated actually last May from the University of Pennsylvania, Ben Franklin's Legacy. I went and saw her. I was super proud.
How
And
proud I would be too.
so anyway, she was given your book, and it helped her understand that there was things that was not normal. She disagreed with, I think, some of the things you got to understand from her perspective. I'll get into how it got to me here in a second, but from her perspective, she grew up mostly in New Jersey, so there was some political things that she didn't agree with. I think that. She didn't agree with some of the women's roles that was in the book. However, I was looking at it and I was like, if it's confrontational in today's world, it doesn't make it wrong. Not everything that's somewhat confrontational or you disagree with is wrong, you know? Sometimes you disagree with something and it's right. So, I don't have any specific examples, but I do know that there was some disagreement there. So I was telling her how much I was into wanting to understand what my goal was, how hard I was working on my goal, how I was going to go to college and things like that. So she hands me your book and she says, "Here, take it." And after I read it, I started really realizing some of the things that I was doing wrong. I started realizing a lot of the habits that I had was because of the social and economic class. I also realized about generational poverty a lot. See, I had a pair of grandparents who was Italian immigrants who would have had to have came here try to escape generational poverty. It didn't work. My dad was extremely poor, my mom extremely poor. So my sister was the first college graduate, albeit younger than me. I wish I was the first, but she's got that title.
You're first gen, though, to be college
Yeah.
educated.
First generation. And I don't think my dad even had a high school diploma. I know my mom didn't. My mom, her last grade was seventh grade. She had me at 14 years old, 14 to 15. Yeah. So she didn't have much of a chance. She also experienced some pretty heavy mental health. See, her dad was in the Vietnam War, so he got sprayed with Agent Orange. So by the time my mom was 18, she was having brain tumors. And, that's sort of, so he kind of lived off her disability check, all five of us for a while until it didn't work anymore. So that's the reason why I was mentioning about writing a book from that perspective.
Well, that's something you should do. You
Yeah,
and your
maybe.
sister should do it, or you should do it.
Yeah. I definitely am. It's kind of weird too because maybe it's a part of just being older and being able to talk well, but I've never received anything less than an A on any essay I've ever wrote.
If you, when we're finished, I will send you a worksheet we send to people about how to self-publish. Also, Amazon has a course or something you can download on how to self-publish. Amazon will take your book and distribute it only if you, even if you only have one book.
How did that work? We only have about 10 minutes here. I'm watching the time for us. How did that work for you when it came to publishing your first book? Did it sell more copies than you anticipated? What was
Well,
that like?
yeah, here's how it started. It didn't, there was no big grand design, okay? Basically, what happened is that I was in a director of professional development in a school district in Texas, and I had a principal come to me. She was so upset about her discipline problems, and the school had gotten redistricted from 24% low income to 63% low income in 1 year.
Holy
So all
moly.
of a sudden, she had, like, she said, "Ruby, I had 800, students last year and 900 discipline referrals." She said, "If I have another year like this, I'm not going to make it." And I said, "So tell me what's going on." Well, she couldn't really articulate it, so I finally asked her for a story. Okay. And so I said, "Oh, you're just talking about poverty." And she said, "What do you mean?" And so I started explaining to her the rules. She said, "You need to come share this with my teachers, okay? Because my first husband had grown up in poverty, so I learned the rules in his neighborhood. Then he took a job in the Chicago Board of Trade. We were thrown in with wealthy people. I didn't know those hidden rules either. And so then you kind of understand environments." So, well, I came and shared with her teachers. Well, they told other teachers. So pretty soon I was having too many calls during the day from people outside of the district wanting information. Because it was about that time that Texas had passed a law that you had to pay attention to your scores, your test scores from your kids from poverty, okay? And so then people were calling me all the time. Well, each call took an hour. Well, I didn't have an hour, okay, for everybody that was calling. So what I did then is I thought, okay, I'm just going to put this in writing. And if somebody wants it, I'll say, "Do you have 15 bucks?" So what happened then, I put it in writing. And I, to Xerox, it was 20 bucks. Okay. And so I was reading these magazines about how you self-publish or how you publish books, and they said, well, if you order 500 books, you can have this book for $10. So I said, how do you do that? And they said, well, you got to be a publisher. I said, well, he said, just give yourself a name, okay? So all you do is you go to the bank and set up a DBA, doing business as, which is a bank account strictly for your business, so you can keep track of data. And I did that. And so then when people would call, I'd say, you got $15. So I put the first 500 books on credit card. Okay. $5,000 on a credit card. I thought, well, nothing gained, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I gave away 100 books because I thought they're going to rot in the garage. Okay. And so what happened then is that within 6 months, they were gone. So then I thought, well, okay, I'll order another 500. Okay. Well, within 6 months, they were gone. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And so then I was on the Texas committee to redo teacher evaluation. And one of the people who was on that committee was the woman who was the head of Texas Elementary Principals Association, Sandy Borden in Texas. She said, I gave her a copy of the book and she said, Ruby, I was a principal of a high poverty school. She said, this explains everything. I need you to come talk to the principals. So I went and talked to the principals, and the thing exploded. And so then the way the community side of it got developed is that there was a guy in Ohio who ran a drug treatment center, and he used to call my mother when they needed supplies like baby beds, et cetera, for adults who were in drug treatment. And my mom had, who never read the book, she said to him, hey, my daughter wrote a book. Do you want to read it? Well, if he wants the baby bed, he has to say yes to the book. Okay. So he said, yes. Well, he read it and he called me and he said, Ruby, this explains why our drug treatment program does not work with people in poverty. So then we wrote together. He said, you need to write one for social work. I said, I'm not in that field. I don't know the terminology. So we wrote one together called Bridges. And then Bridges is a community site. So the company now has two arms, K-12 and Bridges, the community side. And that we have that program on the community side. We've taken 140,000 adults in poverty through a program called Getting Ahead. And we get an ROI of anywhere from $5 to $20 a person for every dollar they spend. Okay. So we teach them how to stabilize their reality.
No.
So, no,
Love
that's
that.
how it started.
Yes. Then obviously, I saw one study. It was a little old. It was like 1.7 million copies for the first book.
Yeah, it's almost 1.9 now. And the other books are in that mix. I mean, none of them have sold as much as that first book. Bridges has sold quite a few because it takes those concepts and puts them into the frame of a community and the different people in the community, businesses, healthcare, law enforcement, returning citizens, people who've been incarcerated, and how you get them back into society, working again, that kind of business. But yeah, it was
Never
a
would have
shock.
thought. Yeah.
It was a
Well,
shock.
one thing here, you already sent me that self-publishing thing.
Oh,
It's
good. I
literally
thought I had. Yeah.
it's pinned to the top of my email. I've talked to several friends about it, and some of them are, I have one friend in particular who grew up probably poorer than me, and he's like, why would you write a book? He totally supports me in it, but it kind of feels kind of impostery because if you can believe it, he was poorer than me. It's kind of like when you hear other people's stories that are kind of worse than yours, it kind of puts you like, well, maybe he deserves to write it more, but it's like, well, if you're
No.
gonna write it, you gotta
Get
write it,
that
man.
thought out of your head.
Yeah.
The bottom line is you can't, one of the things in poverty, there's this idea that if I do better than somebody else, then I either have to bring them along with me or I have to feel bad about what I did. Okay. And you got to
Man,
get
I've
rid
had
of it.
that thought. My gracious. I feel like every time we talk, I have like two or three aha moments where I just have to like slouch and like think and like, oh my gosh, like that's a like a aha moment. Like I can't believe I didn't know that.
Well, here's the thing, nobody will tell it to you. Okay. They won't tell you that, hey, you can't bring people along with you. And number two, you can't feel bad about where you are. All right. And I didn't learn that for a good 20 years into the business. I kept trying to bring people along, and you can't.
Usually, I guess they kind of hinder your growth and hurt.
Because you don't want to hurt their feelings. You want to make sure everybody's okay. And that's BS. The bottom line is you can't own their feelings for them. They have to own them. And if they're not willing to own their own feelings and address their own reality, okay. All right. They're not. Okay. I'll just tell you this story. I had a disabled brother. He got Parkinson's very young. Okay. And then he got cancer and he died. Okay. Had four children. Okay. So, and one of his children is severely disabled. I mean, he's 30 years old. He can't feed himself. He can't go to the bathroom by himself. So his wife took care of the child. Do you follow me? Well, I bought the property so they'd have a place to live and not be homeless. You know, I gave them money. I paid for two of the children to get college educated, one college educated and one certified in diesel mechanics. Do you know what I mean? And at one point in time, then what happened was, so in a period of about 15 years, I spent about $500,000 on the family. Do you follow me? Just to keep them out of, okay. Well, two of the children decided that they were going to take me apart because I, quote unquote, had not given enough to them. All right. So finally, I had a come to Jesus meeting and I put it out on paper to everybody in the family because I wanted the rumors to stop. I wanted there to be clarity about the record. Okay. And why things were the way they were. And people were shocked. They said, "Oh, you mean that you actually did that and I didn't know that?" I said, "Why would I have told you?" But the bottom line is at some point in time, there's always going to be resentment because it's quote unquote never enough. And so there's a rule here. When one person is a giver, and the other per when one person is always the giver and the other person is always the taker, eventually both sides hate each other.
Yeah, there's a lot of knowledge in that. I see the differences just between a very obviously I'm not rich, I just but I see the differences between people who make $400 a week and myself who's about 1200 a week. And I get a lot of questions. My wife's mom is probably big. She usually looks at us and we'll have a vehicle. To me, I gotta have a newer vehicle. Reliable transportation is really important to me. So, we have a very reasonably priced SUV. It's a Jeep Compass. It was like $30,000, very low end, And she looks at it like it's might as well be Donald Trump's motorcade
Yes. And her thing is, why aren't you doing it for me?
And it's like, there's a lot of things. So you talked about this. We'll be on here for another hour, but you talked about it. I mean, you got to have the resources. It's not just a car. You got to pay the taxes and the insurance and the tire rotation and the oil changes after the first five are free if you buy a new one. But
And she, I think one of the things that people don't understand, particularly when you own a business, is that. Yes, you can look at the revenue, but you got to look at the expenses and the unexpected expenses and the stuff you didn't know was going to happen to you, the cost of employee mistakes. Like, I'll just give you one example. The federal government has this rule, okay, that you have exactly 48 hours after payday. Okay, to make your automatic electronic deposits for payroll taxes.
Yeah, sure.
Exactly. Okay. Well, I had an employee. She was absent on Friday. On Monday, she forgot to do it. When she remembered, it was Tuesday morning and we'd missed our 48 hours. Okay. The fine for missing that was $4,000. Okay,
Oh,
which
man.
was as much, which was about a third of the payroll. That was the fine. And you have to pay it. And I could not ask her to pay it. I had to pay it. And so the bottom line is, you understand as a business owner, this is going to happen. People make mistakes. It's the reality.
We manage our business through QuickBooks, and a lot of that we can automate a lot of it for the business that I manage. But for the podcast portion, I haven't made any money yet. I'm negotiating my first $1,000 with somebody over the last couple of days for some podcast sponsors. And I'm hoping it works out because I think it has a lot of potential, Ruby, because in my first five episodes, I've had over 100,000 views. So I think later on, people will start, paying for maybe some sponsor spots or something. But I told a guy he wanted to market his book, and I'm going to Egypt here next month. And I told him, I said, "Hey, listen, I said, if you want, I will stand in front of the Giza pyramids and I will do a review of your book for YouTube." And I told him, I was like, that and a couple other things would be $1,000. And he's reviewing it with his team. So I hope, fingers crossed, that I make my first money as a business of my own. I've made all kinds of money for other people so far, but we'll find out if I can make some for myself. So.
Oh, that's cool. Well, sign me up for another, send me another invite, and I'll talk about some things I want to do with that new book about how the hidden rules impact your career. And there's a chart. Do you ever show charts on or attach things to your, where we could talk through the chart on your podcast, but it's about what you have to do, what the tasks are at, when you're paid hourly wage, what the tasks are in a company that you have to know about and do if you want to be in mid-management, and then what you have to do at executive level. Because one of the things a lot of people in middle class never get promoted to executive level because they don't understand the hidden rules of that position.
I really would be extremely interested in that because business management. I have 12 years of business management. I'm a business major in college. I got accepted, hopefully, into the University of Tennessee for a master's, a graduate program in management. And so I have a lot of experience in management. I'd really like to know how to get into that executive level.
Executive level,
So.
and they get kicked out because they don't know. See, the executive level operates off the hidden rules of wealth. And if you don't know those, then you just don't get in.
That would be
Anyway, so
extremely
yeah, we could talk
interesting.
about that next time.
Yeah, sure. I want to just say how much I appreciate you continually talking to little old Randy, and
I
you are
appreciate little
beautiful.
old Randy talking to me.